Hello, friends, and welcome to Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. I'm Rita Peters, and I'm here in the studio with my co-host, Dean Welty. We've got a great program planned for you today, and we are so glad you have joined us for it again. One quick thing that we want to make you aware of is that this program is a rebroadcast discussing my book, Restoring America's Soul. Now, I wrote the book when I was still Rita Dunaway, but don't let that throw you. It's still me, and I hope you enjoy the program.
Hello, friends, and welcome to another edition of Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. I'm Dean Welty with Rita Dunaway, and we're continuing our walk through Rita's new book entitled Restoring America's Soul. Now, for those who may be new to Crossroads or perhaps missed some of our earlier programs, let me just give you a quick review. First, we began talking about what we as conservatives believe and what we are for rather than just what we are against. We're working to conserve from our rich heritage all that is good. But then we talked about the importance of tone and civility in all of our conversations, especially on the hot-button issues of politics, religion, and morality. And that also means we need to listen to each other. Third, we stress the importance of making decisions on what we know to be true and good rather than just on our feelings and emotions, which often get us into trouble by telling us that if it feels good, do it. And then fourth, we reviewed how closely conservatism is connected to our great Judeo-Christian heritage, how the Founding Fathers applied their beliefs to creating our constitutional system of government, and why all of that still matters to us today. And then number five, against that background, we moved into some specific hot-button issues. For example, who does a better job of caring for the poor, conservatives or liberals? And next, we talked about our religious liberty. The Constitution specifically protects our religious freedoms from government control. But when those rights are challenged by other groups, who wins? And then, finally, that brings us to our hot issue of today. And it's a simple matter of life and death. And the question is, does an unborn baby have the right to live? Or do the mother and her doctor have a contrary right to take that life away? Before we begin, some of our listeners might be asking, well, what qualifies Rita, or anyone else for that matter, to take on this daunting task of restoring America's soul? So, let me just give you a couple of items. First of all, Rita is a constitutional attorney with honors degrees from West Virginia University and the Washington and Lee University School of Law. She's worked as staff counsel for the Rutherford Institute, allied attorney for the highly respected Alliance Defending Freedom, and is now the national legislative strategist for the Convention of States Project. She's a syndicated columnist who's written for numerous media outlets, including her column for the Daily News Record. And, of course, she is the co-host of our weekly Crossroads programs. So, she's qualified. Let's just make that a matter of record. Rita, can you tell our listeners where they can get a copy of your book? Let's start with that.
Absolutely. I want to encourage our listeners who don't have the book yet to get on down to Blessings Christian Bookstore. It's located at 313 Neff Avenue right here in Harrisonburg. And Blessings is a sponsor of this Crossroads program. So I want to encourage you, if you're local, visit Blessings. They also have a great selection of cards, which I personally love. If you're not local or can't make it to Blessings, you can get the book on Amazon. And again, it's Restoring America's Soul.
Well, Rita, I think this is one of the most important chapters of your book. It's a matter of life and death.
Yes.
But just in case our listeners think we expect all of them to see this issue just as we do, we don't. And that's because we've all had different experiences that we bring to the table on the subject of abortion. Right. And I'll just start speaking personally. My wife and I moved to Washington, D.C. back in 1972. That's a little bit before you were born. But it's also just before the Supreme Court legalized abortion the following year. I didn't even know it had happened. And I didn't care. But 10 years later, I was assigned to work in the Department of State for the Office of Chinese Affairs. It was in that position, and because I didn't know any better, that I defended China's one-child policy that included forced abortions and infanticide for unwanted baby girls. Now, how could I justify that? Well, first of all, I was ignorant. Secondly, China was overpopulated, and in my mind, they had to do something. But I also didn't want abortion to become a problem in our bilateral U.S.-China relations. After all, that was my job, and I was totally clueless about the morality of this issue. But then three things happened to change my mind. First, our pastor preached about what the Bible says about abortion. Three words: it is wrong. Well, I had to think about that. Second, I realized that I needed help to understand the issue better. So I read a book by Randy Alcorn entitled Pro-Life Answers to Pro-Choice Arguments. And the light went on, because it showed me the same thing that my pastor had said, but in much greater detail. Abortion is wrong. But third, I had a personal experience. I held my tiny, newborn, first grandson named Samuel in my hands, and that settled it. These were life-changing experiences, and I knew then that we had to be a voice for those who had no other voice. So, Rita, that's my story. Our listeners have their stories, but that leads right into our topic today, because I love how you begin this chapter talking about your experience staffing our pro-life booth at the Rockingham County Fair.
Yeah, and Dean, I want to thank you for sharing your story. You know, it's never easy for someone to say, I used to have this position, then I studied the issue and realized I was wrong, and I changed my position. I think that takes a lot of moral courage, and I appreciate your courage and your honesty.
Well, thank you.
The Rockingham County Fair booth, it's the Valley Family Forum booth, which you usually twist my arm into working a certain number of evenings. And I am just amazed every year at how fascinated especially young people are when they see those life-size baby models that we always have at the booth. Some of them, Dean, seem surprised to see that a baby in the womb well before birth looks like a baby. Because, of course, that is what it is. It isn't just some glob of cells, but it's fun to watch their reactions.
Well, I'll say a little bit more later about that experience. It is terrific. But Rita, in your book, you say that the issue of abortion offers conservatives what you call a shining opportunity to showcase the essence of ideology. What do you mean by essence of ideology?
As we've discussed in previous chapters, one of the main points of the whole book is that a conservative, in the true sense of the word, is someone who works to conserve what is good in our culture and in our government. For today's conservatives, I think that idea has really become fuzzy because of how far we've strayed from the founder's idea of morality, the strength of Judeo-Christian traditions, and the Constitution's design of our federal system of government. So today, it seems like we have to spend a lot of time as conservatives opposing and resisting things. But you see, we can, and I would say we must, frame our position first in terms of what it is that we support, so that we aren't primarily opponents. We're primarily supporters of something that is good and virtuous. So the reason that I believe that this abortion issue is an opportunity for us to start doing this better is because it's so easy to make a positive case for the pro-life position.
Well, Rita, that's exactly right. You referred to being at our pro-life booth at the county fair, and you referred to some people who believe that a baby is just a shapeless glob of cells. We're not making that up.
No.
In fact, I remember one college-educated lady who came to our booth, and she was amazed, as most people are, at the fine features of these little fetal models ranging between between 12 and 26 weeks. And like you said, she expected to see, and these are her words, something like a little lima bean instead of the beautifully formed babies she saw even in the very earliest stages of life. We even have them going back to 7 weeks. Mm-hmm. Tiny little things.
Yep.
But that confirms what you just described as the opportunity we have to support what is good. It is why we say that we are pro-life instead of anti-abortion, which is how the liberal media likes to describe us. So it seems like we're on the right track.
Absolutely. And I would say that the next step for us is to make sure that we emphasize this consistently and emphatically beyond just the label of being pro-life. If we're asked, for instance, why we're pro-life, many would jump immediately to abortion is wrong or abortion is murder, and that is true. But I submit that it would be more fruitful to start with explaining that we believe every single human life is precious, regardless of the circumstances of conception or conditions of disability. We should emphasize that we believe every human being has the potential to make some meaningful contribution to the world in some way. Talk about how we believe that every human being from conception until natural death has unalienable rights, including the right to life.
Rita, you just took a couple words out of one of our founding documents, the Declaration of Independence, where it says we're created equal and endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life is our number one right. But you also talk about the fact that people, maybe kids especially, have an innate tendency to understand that it is wrong to take the life of an innocent, vulnerable human being. And I can only add to the experiences you've had in our booth every summer at the Augusta and Rockingham County Fairs, that children are immediately drawn to these little fetal models, and they love to watch the ultrasound video that shows a baby moving around in his or her mommy's tummy. We call it the baby's playroom. But they want to hold the little babies in their hands and then take a free one home with them. And to your point, even though we don't talk about abortion itself, I remember one teenage girl walked away from the booth just talking to herself. And this is what she said: I would never have an abortion. She got it.
That is powerful. Very powerful. We can see evidence of abortion activists' awareness of this, even in the language that they use. They don't talk about a baby or human life. They don't talk about killing. They hide behind words like privacy, choice, reproductive rights, or my least favorite of all, Dean, women's rights. I find that offensive, and maybe we'll get into that later.
I'm not a woman, so I can identify that, but you clearly have strong feelings about it. Well, then, Rita, if I hear you correctly, our primary goal is to emphasize the undeniably positive nature of the pro-life position. And I like the acronym SLED. And that is used to illustrate that an unborn baby is a human being just like an adult in so many ways. The only differences are its size, that's S, its level of development, L, its environment, E, and its degree of dependency, SLED. But as you point out in this chapter, we do need to be aware of and even expose some pretty ugly realities about abortion.
I want to give a word of caution here before we get into these, because it's so important for us to be careful in our tone and our attitude when we do this. But here's what I'm talking about. The same activists, organizations, politicians, and individuals who are constantly pushing to make abortion easier, cheaper, and more widely available are the same ones who preach about the values of diversity, equality, and liberation.
Well, that is ironic, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because recent data indicate that over 60% of abortions are obtained by women of color, including Black and Hispanic women, despite the fact that they only account for a little over a quarter of the population. So, support for liberal abortion laws actually results in a disproportionate killing of babies in a racial minority population, and so much for diversity.
Yeah, it's a sad truth, and it's one that we need to help make people aware of. Who really cares about these racial minorities? Is it the groups who just say they do and talk about diversity and equality? Or is it the groups who literally want to help them protect their babies?
Well, and Rita, we also need to point out that abortion has had a profound effect on the world's population of females, particularly in Asia. And I mentioned earlier in connection with my work in China. But tell us more about that.
In this context, we aren't talking about the harmful effects of abortion on the women who have the procedure. We're talking about the fact that in Asia, the combination of liberal abortion policy, China's former one-child policy, and technology that enables women to know the gender of their unborn baby, those three things have combined to lead to the deaths of over 160 million unwanted baby girls. That is tragic.
Well, and when we know that, it just seems absurd for abortion activists to talk about abortion as if we're all about empowering women.
Exactly. Because in reality, it's an attack on women and their female babies.
Well, another whole aspect of that abortion issue that some Americans are likely unaware of is that our own abortion laws here in America are actually far more liberal than other parts of the world.
That's exactly right. And it's to the point, Dean, where other nations would be justified in considering our abortion policies barbaric. And I'll just give you one example of that. In Germany, Denmark, Belgium, and France. Now, these are nations generally thought of as models of progressive society. But in those countries, abortions after 12 weeks are either illegal or heavily regulated after 12 weeks.
And that's certainly better than our own laws, which by virtue of the Supreme Court decisions in Roe v. Wade, for example, the court effectively requires states to permit abortion throughout pregnancy, as long as the woman can find a doctor willing to say that her life or health would suffer from continuing the pregnancy. And the shocking thing is that our own state is going in that same direction. We know that New York passed a law permitting abortion after 24 weeks right up to birth, but then we were shocked when Democrat legislators in Virginia tried to pass the same kind of law, and Governor Ralph Northam actually supported it, even allowing a baby to die after a botched abortion.
And what's important to understand about these laws that allow for a late-term abortion if it's needed for the woman's quote-unquote health is that that word health is not defined. So if a medical professional thinks, for instance, that an abortion would protect a woman's mental health, very subjective, that would satisfy the requirement.
That's a classic example, I think, of the slippery slope, because exceptions used to be limited to cases in which the actual life of the mother was at stake, as you said, but is now being expanded to apply more generally to the health of the mother, which would allow for abortion at any time, just as Governor Northam has supported.
Well, what's really appalling to me is that I can't see any logical end to radical abortion activists' arguments. And here's what I mean. Back in the days of Roe versus Wade, those lobbying for legalized abortion were always careful to say that they wanted abortion to be safe, legal, and rare. Well, what happened to that? Once they got their wish for abortion to be legal, they immediately moved on to seeking to make it common, widely available, cheap, and they even want taxpayers to pay for it now so that it would be available for free.
Well, again, it's a classic example of the slippery slope, because if you allow for one exception, it opens the door to a dozen others. Now, as far as their appeal to make abortion safe, I'm reminded of the huge scandal that happened in Philadelphia in 2011 with former abortionist Kermit Gosnell, who was running a disgusting abortion clinic where women and babies were dying. So where's the outrage of the abortion activists and the mainstream media against what he was doing. They routinely ignored any stories that might reflect badly on the abortion industry. And Dr. Gosnell might have escaped prosecution altogether, except that he was being investigated under suspicion for illegal drug trafficking. That's what turned the spotlight on his clinic, and as a result, he was eventually charged on 8 counts of murder and other felony counts of performing illegal late-term abortions and even of killing infants born alive after botched abortions. He was convicted and sentenced to life in prison without parole, plus 30 years. I don't know how you can add 30 years onto life in prison, but that was the scandal that was turned into a movie entitled Gosnell, America's Biggest Serial Killer, which opened last October in 750 theaters across America. A powerful expose of the horrors that take place every day behind closed doors in abortion clinics across America.
Well, Dean, while we're on the subject of movies on this topic, I know that you recently went to see the movie Unplanned, and I haven't gotten to see it yet. So tell us just a little bit about that.
Janet and I did attend the opening night of the film that showed here in Harrisonburg, and the theater was absolutely packed, including, I'm sure, many of our listeners from the Valley. Unplanned is a story of Abby Johnson, a former worker in a Planned Parenthood clinic. She was a rising star, and she had helped facilitate over 20,000 abortions during her work there. But a couple things happened. She was faced with a complicated abortion that nearly took the life of a young mother and certainly the child who was butchered in the process. It's a graphic movie that's difficult to watch. But the second thing she discovered is that Planned Parenthood doesn't care about the woman and certainly about the baby. They are in it for the money. That insight turned her life around. She left Planned Parenthood and actually went to work for a pro-life organization, 40 Days for Life. Talking to women going into abortion clinics, just as some of her clients were spoken to across the fence of her clinic. And she has become, Abby Johnson, one of the most powerful spokesmen for life in America. And in fact, after the release of her movie, over 100 former employees of Planned Parenthood have left that organization to go to work in other fields, including pro-life.
That is astounding. What a powerful testimony, and what a powerful reminder of God's redemptive power, how he can use anyone. There is no one beyond his power to redeem. And what the enemy intends for evil, he can use for good.
Near the end of your chapter, you mentioned 3 specific pitfalls you want pro-lifers to be aware of. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. Well, first of all, we need to make it clear that we do care about the mother as well as the baby. I know this to be true of every pro-lifer I know, but let's make sure that it comes across in our messaging. Second, don't let the abortion lobby succeed in pegging us as old-fashioned old people. Not that there's anything wrong with either one of those. Pro-life activism is a cause that young people can and do get behind, as we've already discussed. It's also a cause that is greatly bolstered by science and technology, such as the use of ultrasounds. We need to emphasize that. And third, let's be careful with our tone. Yes, it's clear in the Bible that killing an unborn baby is wrong, but some people will tune us out as soon as we make that our primary argument. So let's be careful that we're taking our stand in an attitude of humility and grace.
Well, Rita, those are certainly pitfalls that we would try to avoid as much as possible. But I have to say, on your second point, that anyone who has ever attended a pro-life march or rally has to be blind if they think it's all about old-fashioned old people. We attended 3 of them already this year, starting with a March for Life in Washington and then 2 more in Richmond. And I would say that about 80% of those pro-life marchers our young people. And I'd also add to your third point about using the Bible to make our case for life. Chuck Colson said at one time, unless we're talking to fellow believers, we should avoid beginning our argument by saying, the Bible says, yes, it's true, but it carries no weight with unbelievers. And in fact, it may have the opposite effect on them. But back to your point, what do you think our primary policy goals should be on this issue right now?
Well, I'll give you three to start with. First of all, we need to eliminate all forms of taxpayer funding for organizations that perform and promote abortion.
Absolutely. And that goes back to the Hyde Amendment, which prohibits any federal funding for abortion-related activities or organizations overseas. Bans like this should also be enforced in budgets at the state level, including Virginia. But so far, unfortunately, that has been difficult.
Second policy goal, we need to establish legal personhood for every member of the human family, including the unborn.
Well, Rita, this whole issue of personhood, I know you've been involved in speaking on this at different times. Can you explain why that is so important?
The whole decision in Roe versus Wade was premised on this legal conclusion that an unborn baby was not a person within the meaning of the 14th Amendment, so didn't have a right to life. So we can use the states in particular to change those laws to specifically recognize that unborn babies from the moment of conception are legal persons and do have a right to life.
Perfect. What's your third one?
The third one is to refuse to allow abortion clinics to become legalized back alleys, sort of like you were describing with the Gosnell Clinic.
This is so important in Virginia. Several years ago, for example, our pro-life legislators in Richmond put together and passed some commonly accepted health and safety regulations and standards that abortion clinics need to meet, just like all other surgical outpatient clinics are required to do. And that is just common sense to protect women. But then the abortion lobby got all excited. They complained that these standards are too strict and even unnecessary. Meeting them would be too expensive, forcing them to close down in some areas. As a result, they either try to ignore the standards or get their Democrat legislators to remove or weaken them. What hypocrisy for clinics who claim that they are pro-women when in actuality they are actively supporting a return to what looks like back alley abortions that they claim to hate. Well, Rita, we've covered a lot of ground, but we're almost out of time. Can you give us your 1 minute elevator speech?
Let's see if it's 1 minute. Every life matters, and every single human being, no matter what circumstances he or she may have been born into, has intrinsic value and dignity. That's why I support efforts to promote every member of the human family from conception until natural death. I know it sounds attractive to let women choose for themselves whether to have an abortion or not, but the bottom line is that in a civilized society, there are some choices we must place off limits, specifically choices that interfere with the rights of another human being. So if science demonstrates that a new, distinct human being exists from the time of conception, then it is the explicit duty of government and the moral duty of society to protect him or her. A humane society simply can't allow one human being to end the life of another innocent human being. I know that some pregnant women are unable to provide for a baby or are not in the position to parent a child, but there are plenty of resources available from pregnancy resource centers and other programs to help moms in need. And there are countless loving families eager to adopt a baby and provide a caring, stable home. No situation is beyond hope.
Ding, we've just arrived at the 12th floor, Rita. So you got it all in. Well, thank you so much for walking us through this review from your book about restoring America's soul and this chapter on the savvy pro-lifer. For our listeners, if you're just joining us, we've been talking with Rita Dunaway, author of a new book entitled Restoring America's Soul. She'll be back with us again next week as we take on another big question: is natural marriage worth conserving? And again, I would encourage everyone to get your own copy of Rita's book so you can follow along with us for the final chapters.
Thanks again to our generous sponsors at Blue Ridge Chimney Services, Blessings Christian Bookstore, Sunshine Ministries with Christian Radio, Wishing Well Florists and Travel Services, and our good friends at New Beginnings Church and Garber's Church of the Brethren in Harrisonburg. I'm Rita Peters with Dean Welty and engineer Robbie Meadows, inviting you to join us again next week for another edition of Crossroads, where faith and culture meet.
Rejoice, rejoice, rejoice.